They're patrolling Jacksonville school campuses with weapons, but they are not police. Just ahead, why local parents are going to court. Good Monday morning. We're live from Studio 5 for First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. And just ahead, a closer look at the lawsuit opposing armed safety assistance in local elementary schools in Duval County. What do you think about this? Give us a call right now at 549-2937. Then later, Andrew Gillum's impact on local African-American voters. That's in our Real Talk. Plus, the Jaguars lose their final home game of the season. Were you there? Culpepper has a look at that. All of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, the lawsuit against Duval County Public Schools for hiring armed staffers to patrol elementary school grounds has been refiled. This after the initial complaint was rejected on technical grounds. Now, here's what it's all about. Local parents are arguing that the school system has gone outside the law in placing these armed assistants on school campus because they are not sworn police officers. Patricia Brigham is president of the League of Women Voters of Florida, also involved in this lawsuit, and she's on the line now with more. Patty Brigham, thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Good to be here.
And here's our question to callers. Where do you stand on armed safety assistance in the Duval County Public Schools, in elementary schools? The school district is putting them there in response to a new state law. Do they make young children more or less safe? What are your thoughts and comments about this lawsuit? Give us a call at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Go online as well and send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax and lots of comments on this already on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. We'll get to those in just a moment. Patricia Brigham, this is an action you're saying the League of Women Voters of Florida, along with several local parents, to protect elementary school children from the risk of harm. Now, of course, the Duval County Public Schools has placed these armed safety assistants on campus ostensibly to protect students, make them more safe from a gunman that might enter a school campus. Why are you alleging that this new initiative, this new program, would make the kids less safe?
Well, the league has long time advocated against putting guns onto campuses, from public school campuses to college and university campuses. And studies have shown that putting more guns into areas where there are people who are vulnerable do not make people safer. And that especially is the case with children. There were recent events in Florida that have demonstrated that putting these school safety assistants on these campuses will place children at risk. Even police officers make mistakes. One, for example, was suspended for a physical altercation with a student just months ago, former Jacksonville police officer. In 2017, in Margate, Florida, an officer was suspended for using excessive force against a fourth grade student. So we're not talking here about law enforcement either. We're talking about hired school safety assistants that were not deemed a part of the Guardian program during the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Act of earlier this year that the legislature passed. These people would be armed, would receive very little training, and they would be so-called the protectors of these children. It's a very bad idea.
It's 549-2937 to join us now. Duval County established this program, the SSA program, Safe School Officer Program, in response to the legislation that was enacted earlier this year, the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School Public Safety Act. Of course, that's named after the high school in Parkland in South Florida, where an armed student killed 17 students and staff. And in order to fulfill this requirement, Duval could have put police officers employed by the sheriff's department on campus, police officers employed by the school district on campus, or the third option, putting school guardians on campus that they hire, that become school employees, in effect, carrying weapons. Your lawsuit is alleging that only sworn police officers should be armed and on campus. Is that right?
Right, and that is the law. It is illegal to carry concealed weapons or openly carry weapons onto campuses by civilians. The only ones who are lawfully able to do that are school resource officers who are, in fact, trained law enforcement officers.
And if you're just tuning in as we talk about this, where do you stand on armed safety assistance patrolling local Duval County public schools, elementary schools? We'll go to your calls in just a moment at 549-2937. Now, current school board officials cannot comment on this litigation. However, we did speak with Scott Shine, a recently departed member of the Duval County School Board. He was involved in this initiative, and here's what he had to say. Take a listen. Scott Shine, thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Melissa. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Now, as a former member of the Duval County School Board, you can speak about this lawsuit more freely than the current board members. They can't address the pending litigation, according to a spokeswoman. So let me get your thoughts on this complaint that's been filed against the school system and the school board. The lawsuit is saying that Duval County schools just aren't within their rights to place these armed assistants on school property. What's your response to that?
Well, I think some of the issues that have been brought up on the lawsuit probably are not sustainable. The one issue they've brought up is whether or not individuals can carry a firearm on school property. And there's a statute that may be in conflict with that. What will probably happen is in the next legislative session, if that is an error, it'll be corrected. And so that point of the lawsuit will be remedied.
This is being called an unfunded mandate by critics of how Duval County has gone about fulfilling the requirement from the state that each school district provide a safe school officer at every school. Duval went about this with the budget they had. Do you think it's accurate to call this an unfunded mandate from Tallahassee?
Well, there was partial funding that was granted, and to execute on this with fidelity, it did require more funding. It's interesting that years ago, we actually had more officers in schools. Elementary, we went to security, and then eventually we made cuts there. After the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas incident, that certainly reframed everything that we need to look at. So we are having to go into the funding that would normally go into the classroom to provide these security officers.
What about parents' concerns, Scott? Their worries that their children will simply possibly be in the line of fire if a situation happens where an armed safety assistant is required to draw his or her gun, and parents are concerned that these individuals who aren't sworn police officers, they don't believe, or they are just simply not well-trained enough to be up to this task. What's your response to parental concerns?
Well, I would like to put their minds at ease. The amount of training that these security assistants are going to have, I believe it's around 144 hours. It's just a few hours short of a Florida law enforcement certificate. One of the problems that the district is having is actually finding people who are qualified. So many of the people who apply are dropped due to problems in their background. They have to do a polygraph. They have to do a psychological exam. The psychological assessment takes about 6 hours, and they meet one-on-one with a psychologist. So the problem now is that we're getting about 5 to 15% of applicants, selected applicants, into these positions. So there's a very rigorous training program. And when you look at security outside of law enforcement, these will be some of the most trained security officers that you will see anywhere in the state of Florida.
Duval County former school board member Scott Shine, thanks so much for sharing your thoughts with us.
You're quite welcome. Thank you, Melissa.
Okay, Patricia Brigham, president of the League of Women Voters of Florida, a former school board member, just now saying these will be some of the most trained security officers anywhere in the state. What about that?
Well, I would beg to differ. These school safety assistants will not receive the ongoing tactical training that police officers receive. And oftentimes, police don't even hit their mark. successfully. Look, I mean, putting these school safety assistants on campus is only going to bring greater risk to the children, the faculty, and the staff, and any members of the public who are on campus on a day where there could be a shooting. And what will happen when police arrive on a scene and you've got a civilian who's holding a gun and firing the weapon and has accidentally, you know, shot and killed a student or a teacher? Look, this is asking for disaster. There are better ways to go about protecting our schools than arming them. And if, you know, we do have school resource officers who are trained law enforcement officers. They are the ones who have traditionally been on these school campuses. Bringing civilians on with not adequate training, not even anything like what police officers undergo yearly, is not the answer.
And as we talk about the lawsuit that has just been refiled, a complaint against armed safety assistants in local elementary schools in Duval County, filed by the parents of young children and the League of Women Voters of Florida. What are your thoughts, comments, questions? In a moment, we're going to talk about the mental health aspect of this, how we as parents can talk about this with our kids. I know that's on the minds of a lot of you out there, but first, let's go to some calls. 549-2937. Mike is on the South Side. Hi, Mike. Good morning.
Good morning, Liz. How's it going?
Good, thanks. Thanks. Go ahead.
Yeah, my comment was, and I'll try to make it brief. When I first heard that they want to put, you know, civilian trained personnel in the school, I had the same concerns that your guest did. You know, being a former police officer, not here in Jacksonville, but just in another state. Even the regular officers, as she said, don't normally get that type of tactical training. And it's a whole different environment when you're inside a building and you have, you know, bystanders. It's a whole different decision process. And when I first heard it, I cringed because all I thought of was it just a lawsuit waiting to happen. And I don't agree with it. I will say that I currently work in the school system, but I'm not going to say which one.
And can you tell us what you do there?
I'm a social worker.
Okay.
I'll say that. And I was told that, you know, even certain personnel in the school don't even know who these people are. But it just seems like it's a lawsuit waiting to happen. I know we want our kids safe, but if we're going to do it.
Well, and the lawsuit's here. Sure. Yeah. Well, what do you think is the solution then, Mike?
Put specialized trained officers who receive training, you know, use on a quarterly basis, and they have the ability to at least make better judgments than civilians who only get, what is it, 200 hours of training. I'm not exactly sure what the course was, but that would be better.
Okay.
That would be better.
Thanks, Mike. Patricia Brigham, the former school board member Scott Shine, said he thought that the legislature might take this matter up in March. Is it your hope that this situation could be tweaked, revised in any way to become more in line with what that school employee Mike is saying?
Well, we're hopeful that that the legislature would decide it's a very bad idea to arm anyone on school campuses other than law enforcement. However, we're further concerned that the Parkland Commission came out last week and recommended arming teachers. So we have a significant problem in our state and in other states when we think that the solution to these school shootings, which are horrific, but they are not daily shootings, when we're thinking that the answer is to put more guns into places where guns are the problem in the first place. That is just not the answer. It's not the answer in schools. It's not the answer in the home. For example, when studies have shown that if there's a gun in the home, the gun owners are far more likely to be harmed with it than an intruder. So, you know, magnify that in a school situation where there are young children who many of whom have disabilities, may not understand instruction or direction. If a school safety assistant is giving them, This is about untrained civilians carrying guns in elementary schools. It is absolutely unacceptable.
Lots of calls about this meanwhile. Let's go to Anthony in Orange Park. Hello, Anthony. Good morning. Go ahead. Hi, Anthony. Are you there?
Yeah, good morning. I just wanted to say this. We're taking human beings and we're thrusting them into a chaotic environment. We're not training anybody how to de-escalate the situation, and we're not looking at the challenge from a holistic perspective. I think there's some other solutions, but my main comment is this. Let's not add more guns to an already chaotic environment. That's all I have to say.
Okay, Anthony, thank you. And, you know, I have to say, I am not fully aware if the training for these armed safety assistants does include de-escalation training or not, but we will check on that. Meanwhile, at the same time, our news partner, Channel 4 News for Jax, did report recently that one of the guardians employed in Duval County to patrol a school campus was arrested for pawning that gun. So there are lots of tentacles to this story. Lots of comments on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. Andrea writes, I know a gentleman who's a security guard at a local school, and I'm surprised every time I think about it. He's a very unstable, emotionally erratic person, and I would be nervous if he worked in my child's school. Cersei writes on our Facebook page, no, it's just another Band-Aid. Fix the real problem, sensible gun laws, and more mental health support. It's 549-2937 to talk about this. And the issue of mental health always seems to come up when we talk about gun safety in America. We want to talk about this in a special way, though, right now. As local parents worry about the impact of this dynamic on their children, Wendy Hughes is the CEO of Mental Health America of Northeast Florida, and she joins us now in studio. Good morning, Wendy.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. And so this is something that's such a sensitive, difficult topic for parents to discuss with their children.
Yes, it is.
Particularly young children who are asking their parents, am I safe in school? Am I going to have a shooting situation at my campus? And if it happens, am I going to be okay?
Right.
This is just incredibly frightening for kids and parents. So what advice do you have for families right now?
Well, I personally have a ninth grader and a fourth grader, and we have had these conversations, and it is a difficult subject. And the thing that we as mental health professionals recommend, and me as a parent, what I can say is having open and honest conversations. Our kids can't be sheltered from this. This is, unfortunately, their reality.
They've been going through these active shooter drills since kindergarten.
That's right. You know, we don't want this to be their reality, but unfortunately it is. And, you know, I've actually done some research once, you know, with Parkland and the Landing. You know, I began myself to dig into some of the mass shooting statistics. And unfortunately, what my research discovered is that Florida's ranking about third over the last 3 years in mass shooting statistics. And we actually have a higher fatality rate than even California and Illinois.
Pretty discouraging. At the same time, the topic of guns in schools just came up at your national conference, Mental Health America. You run the local chapter of Mental
Right.
Health America. And what was discussed?
You know, we have partnered as a national organization with a gun nonprofit, a nonprofit that is organized by the gun industry called Walk the Talk America. And this is a organization that has committed to educating the gun ownership group within the United States on their rights, their not just their rights, but their responsibility as gun owners for safe practices and they are helping to further mental health awareness and education with regards to responsible gun ownership. And that is exactly what needs to happen. It is a right to own a gun, but you do have the responsibility to safeguard that gun and to carry that gun responsibly. With regards to our children, it is our responsibility as gun owners to keep those out of the hands of our children and to do that responsibly. As with regards to the safety officers being on our campus, whether that be a law enforcement officer or a safety officer in our elementary schools, I think that, you know, regardless of this lawsuit, I think we just talk to our children about it. And we have to instill in them that they are there for their protection, regardless of how we might feel about this right now, because they don't need to be afraid of them right now. And I think that would be more detrimental to them and their mental health right now.
Sure.
I think that I have watched the videos on Duval County's website. I've watched them with my children who have seen them in the school system. And we've talked about it. And I think the fact that Duval County has put them on their website is a positive thing, and that parents can sit down and watch those with their children and have those open discussions about them. And I think that from a fear perspective, that can help children allay those fears.
Siobhan writes on our First Coast Connect Facebook page, "Why do we need to invite this into our school system? Provide the resources that will impact violence, like fully staffed schools, trained mental health counselors, arts education, PE, and you will find violence at schools dropping." Lots more discussion about this on our Facebook page if you want to check that out. And as we continue our discussion with Patricia Brigham, president of the League of Women Voters of Florida, Wendy Hughes, CEO of Mental Health America of Northeast Florida, and we've also heard from former Duval County School Board member Scott Shine, what are your thoughts about this lawsuit opposing armed safety assistants in local schools, not sworn police officers? Lots of calls, lots of tweets, lots of Facebook comments. It's a hot topic for sure. It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Let's go to Rebecca now on the west side. Hi, Rebecca. Thanks for holding. Good morning.
Good morning. I am a teacher in a high school, and so this is something that's always in the back of my mind. But your guest talked about responsible gun ownership. My husband and I are gun owners. Our gun is kept in a two-phase, security system, meaning somebody to access it would have to get through two methods to get access to our gun. When we talk about a lot of the major school shootings, these are by kids who have accessed their parents' weapons. So your guest talked about responsible gun ownership and their responsibilities, but why isn't more being done legislatively to require gun owners to keep their weapons secure? And if they fail to do so, actually having consequences for that failure.
Rebecca, Rebecca, thanks for that. And that's a teacher calling in from the West Side. So Patty Brigham, I know your complaint doesn't deal with her issue, but what about her comments there?
Well, first of all, there is it is a second degree misdemeanor to leave to leave a loaded and unlocked weapon in an area where a minor is present and an adult is not. So that is on the books as a second degree misdemeanor. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of teeth in that because we read about these accidental shootings all the time where a child gets a hold of a loaded gun. They're not accidents. These are preventable shootings, and gun owners have a responsibility to keep them under lock and key. But I just want to, if I could, respond to something that your guest said regarding the importance of talking with children about these school safety assistants and that it's nothing to be afraid of. That may be well and good, and of course we want to have candid conversations with our children, but the very fact that we're having to have a conversation to tell these children there's nothing to be afraid of means there is a concern. And guns are something to be afraid of, and there's something to be afraid of being carried by these school safety assistants who are not law enforcement, who knows what their backgrounds are. More guns is not the answer. There's an answer that none of our lawmakers seem to want to take up, and that is easy access to firearms. We need to limit access to firearms in this state, in this country. We have way too much gun violence, and the answer is so simple, is to make it harder to get a gun. But unfortunately, this is a very divisive issue. It's a very partisan issue, and there seems to be digging in on both sides. But we are asking for common sense gun reform. It's going to take that more than it is conversations to assure our children not to be afraid to make a real difference on gun violence in the state of Florida.
Okay. Wendy Hughes, CEO of Mental Health America of Northeast Florida. Increasingly, activists calling for gun reform in this country are framing it as a public health issue, both in terms of its impact on our mental, our collective mental health, and also the fact that trauma surgeons in particular and those who deal with gun violence on a daily basis in hospital emergency rooms see the damage caused by gun injuries and gun homicides as a public health crisis. As a health professional, do you think that that avenue of activism will hold sway at some point in this country, or is the Second Amendment just too deeply embedded in our political DNA, I guess, for that to get traction with the public? Because when you look at the statistics on this, a bipartisan majority of Americans does want more restrictions on access to weapons. That is a popular issue, but it's just a politically difficult issue to see real change about.
Yes, it is.
To say the least.
To say the least. It is a divisive issue, and I don't know that I want to put a stake in the ground on that one. You know, it is a tough issue. I mean, I'll just say I own guns. I have always owned a gun. It's one of those things. I've just grown up in a culture where I'm from South Georgia. That was part of our culture. I have not trained my kids in that culture because we don't live in that same culture anymore. But I don't think that, I think the Second Amendment right to bear arms is well embedded in our societal DNA, as you put it. And I think that will be a tough issue to crack. I think that the responsibility that goes with that Second Amendment right is something that we as a society need to have more embedded in our culture. Because as a gun owner, that was something that was taught to me very early on. And I have that embedded in my DNA. That was something that...
Being a responsible gun owner.
Being a responsible gun owner. I think there needs to be... That is not transparent to all, though. And we see that. And that is something that we need to figure out as a global society, how we put that in play. And that's the more pressing issue, I think, rather than just the ownership issue.
Guy's in St. Augustine. Hi, Guy. I know you've been holding. Thanks for holding.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Good morning. I've got two high school kids at Bertram, and I'm a gun owner. I'm opposed to the NRA's attitude about nothing should be changed. My kids both are aware of this. They've gone through recent lockdowns in the school to practice for active shooters. I think that the law that permits teachers, if they have and choose to carry a gun, is not bad from a psychological standpoint. Even if no teacher ever chooses to carry the gun in the class, the fact that the shooter that goes into the school doesn't know how many people are armed or possibly armed in the school could be a deterrent, even if there's no guns. You don't go running into a school now with the understanding that everybody's armed, so your chances are going to get load to accomplish whatever craziness you're trying to put forth. So I guess I'm in favor of it. I don't think every teacher or most teachers should have guns in the classroom, but the fact that it could be there would make somebody think, I hope, twice of what their chances are of being successful in their rampage.
All right. Thank you, Guy. And that's Guy, who has kids at Bartram Trail High School, where they've experienced lockdowns. Let's be clear, most schools have been through lockdowns and active shooter drills. So, Patricia Brigham, what about that? Is the perception that a school has several people on campus potentially armed enough of a deterrent, do you think, for someone who is determined to enter a school and cause bodily harm?
There were armed security guards at Columbine, and that did not prevent that mass shooting. There were armed security, and much controversy has been around this at the Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School as to whether or not they performed their jobs responsibly. There have been armed security guards at locations where there have been many mass shootings. So, look, I mean, adding more guns is not the answer. It just adds more risk, especially to our young children. The answer is, and I'm going to say it again, is responsible gun reform and removing easy access to firearms. We are awash in guns in this society, and we are paying the price with repeated mass shootings, with domestic violence shootings, with preventable shootings where these children are getting a hold of guns, and that could happen in these situations in the schools, by the way. We're a society that's awash in guns. It's going to take more than a cultural change. It's going to take some very responsible lawmakers finally putting the interests of the public ahead of their own interest in being reelected or elected or kowtowing to the NRA and doing the right thing.
Now
passing responsible gun laws.
You and local parents have asked for an injunction to stop this program in Duval County. Next steps in this lawsuit, if you could tell us quickly.
Well, that's going to depend on how it unfolds, and that's really a question for the attorneys.
We'll continue to follow it. Thanks so much for joining us. Patricia Brigham, president of the League of Women Voters of Florida. Wendy Hughes is CEO of Mental Health America of Northeast Florida. And we were also joined by former Duval County School Board member Scott Shine. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And much more still ahead later. Cole Pepper will be along with some insights into the Jaguars' loss and Doug Marrone's job security. That's later in the hour, but up next.
What we do know, particularly in Duval County, is that there is a sort of renewed sense of voter engagement.
Real talk about Andrew Gillum's impact on local African-American voters from our own Charles Griggs and friends. That is right after this. Keep listening. Well, Andrew Gillum lost his race for Florida governor in November, losing to governor-elect Ron DeSantis. But he ignited progressive voters across the nation during his campaign. And he fired up African-American voters here on the First Coast as Duval County went blue. In other words, voting for Democratic candidates at the top of the ticket for the first time in many years. In today's Real Talk, featuring voices from the local African-American community, Our regular contributor Charles Griggs talks about Gillum's impact with political strategist Obi Umuna, Pedro Cohen of the YMCA, research scientist Dr. Jeffrey N. Wilder, and Iris Grant from the Genesee Group. Take a listen.
How will this race impact the future of Florida policies in ways that may directly benefit African-American communities? We'll start our discussion with Dr. Wilder. I will, you know, kind of interested to get your thoughts on you know, how do you think that Governor-elect DeSantis will reflect policies related to African-Americans?
Wow, so you give me the hardest question and start out the gate. Okay. I don't think Governor-elect DeSantis is really going to, you know, implement policies that are going to reach all of the constituents in the state of Florida, particularly those of color. I don't recall any time throughout this run him reaching out to our community or communities in general, so I can't really see how that will now be an issue that he turns to in the future. So for me, I think when I look at, of course, very disappointed in the outcome of the election, but I think about the indirect impact that I am hopeful about. Oh, now we're starting to look toward 2020 election. And I don't know all of the, you know, stats related to voter turnout. But what we do know, particularly in Duval County, is that, and maybe some of my other panelists can speak to this a little bit better than I can, is that there is a sort of renewed sense of voter engagement. Hopefully that is sustained through 2020, particularly among older Xennials, right? Mm-hmm. And younger millennials. So folks who are just turned 18 through that 30-year-old group. I think that's really, really important. Also the fact that we now have folks who are felons who can vote now, I think is really, really important. So I think there are a few silver linings in all of this. And I think that's really about continuing to sustain the base that was sort of moved, if you will, to get to the polls in the first place.
So it sounds like you believe that because we have more people to turn out, that the opportunities would be better for us down the road. Obi, I'll ask you, what do you think about how the turnout has impacted chances for different policy decisions down the road?
Well, I always say this, elections have consequences, right? And there will be consequences from this election that will probably not favor people in the African-American community. The African-American community did come out and vote in heavy numbers. And what was really was special was there were new voters, right? Which doesn't normally happen. So the indirect probably advantage is that there are some new people that'll be a part of this process that haven't been a part of this process before, not only as voters, but from the campaigning side, as canvassers and volunteers and the people that have donated to campaigns, that with Andrew's campaign, this was the first time they'd gotten involved. So I say all that to say that these people are going to be the next group of people that are going to help hold these politicians accountable to make sure that their policies aren't forgotten.
So speaking of accountability, I think that's where, I mean, that's really where I think the rubber meets the road. How do you hold them accountable if you're on the losing end of the outcome?
Well, I think from my perspective, I have to agree with both of the previous speakers in terms of elections do have consequences, and some of those consequences may not necessarily be beneficial to the African-American community. But I think the thing that I came away with after the election was that there are going to be 1.4 million new voters into the system just based upon the passage of Amendment 4. And for me, I think that was the only way that you were going to get those people into the system of being able to be voters. And I think if you would have done it any other way, expecting a Republican governor to simply allow people to vote, that just wasn't going to happen. And I think also what the election made possible was the governor-elect has taken a position on pre-existing conditions relative to health care, and also making sure he's going to have to answer for that. And so I think the idea, if there's the caveat, so to speak, of Andrew losing the race, is that we're going to have 1.4 million new voters into the system in 2020. And then secondly, the governor has taken a position on pre-existing conditions relative to health care. here. And the last thing I think came out of this that I woke up this morning, and if I'm the current mayor of Jacksonville, that's something that I would think about, because Duval County became a blue county. And so if I'm looking at this from the perspective of what was traditionally a conservative Republican county, and I woke up and saw that it was blue this morning, I'm starting to pay attention, because what's good for the state may not necessarily be good for Duval County.
Yeah. So, Iris, do you think that when you look at the results and the opportunities, I'm calling them opportunities, when you look at the opportunities, that there will be space for consideration for future elections and how African Americans participate? Because, like, you know, like you, everyone has agreed that the numbers are up. However, the numbers are up on both sides. You know, a lot of people turned out to vote for Republicans, even though in Duval County more Democrats turned out than Republicans. But still, the voter turnout was high on both sides.
I think I see it as a very optimistic point, because I think one thing that our communities, specifically the African-American community or communities of color, do well is grassroots, right? And so we are knocking on doors, we're getting engaged at a different level. And I don't think that the momentum, if we stay true to the methodology of how we connected with those new voters, even though the numbers were high on both sides, those numbers were close,
yeah,
right? They were really, really close. And you just need a little puff of wind to blow that over. And I think that what we do well is when we connect one-on-one and door-to-door in that grassroots fundamental style, we engage and we make a difference. And I think that that difference is enough to stimulate not just the voters, but how, looking at how we do business in our communities, how we push forward, right? Because you've got two more years of people that are going to be turning 18. You've got two more years of people who maybe kind of sat back in the corner and said, let me see what's going to happen. Specifically in Duval, Duval went blue. That should energize them. So I think that I look at this with optimism. I look at who's going to really answer and be responsible for the promises that they made to keep things red, and for us to constantly engage in a way that we do. And then that's in our churches, in our door-to-door communities, our neighborhoods, our face-to-face perspectives.
Where this campaign was lost was in counties, in these super red counties, right? The margins were ridiculous in those counties, mm-hmm. right? And what you see is something that I say all the time, is that people vote against their own interests all the time, right? For very different reasons. And there's a lot smarter people in the room that can get into why they vote against those things. Our questions need to be, how do we grow our base, right? Because we cannot continue to depend on other people to come and save us. We have to find a way to grow our voters and grow our bases and make our margins as big in our areas where there's no dispute.
Well, just as it's getting good, we're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank you all for being here with me on Real Talk, Dr. Jeffrey Ann Wilder, Iris Grant, Dr. Pedro Cohen, and Obi Umla. Thank you very much for being here, and we'll see you next time on Real Talk.
And still ahead on the show.
My job's to win games, and you don't win games. You know, obviously, it's up to the people that make the decisions.
Cole Pepper breaks down the Jaguars' loss on their final home game of the season. That's next. Stay close.
Can $3 billion fix a humanitarian catastrophe?
Of the 30 million people that are living in Yemen, 22 million currently need humanitarian assistance.
A look at the UN aid designated for Yemen and how much has actually reached the Yemeni people. That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Weekdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
After a lifetime of work, and a lot of Americans were ready to retire until the economy collapsed.
And now all of a sudden, like 35% of my money is just gone, like vanished. It was really bad.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Why so many seniors still haven't recovered 10 years after the crisis and what they're doing about it now. That's next time on Marketplace.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
The book An African American and Latinx History of the United States offers some fresh perspectives. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with author Paul Ortiz. We'll discuss the 1887 book, Prehistoric Remains in Florida, and talk about Florida students in France as part of the Veterans Legacy Program. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
The start of winter can be lonely. Yearning for someone to come home to bring to the office party, to snuggle up with, or more. We're taking a week-long look at this seasonal phenomenon, the pain and the possibilities of modern dating. Part one of our special series, Cuffing Season. Next time on 1A.
Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Sports Wrap Up with Cole Pepper is sponsored by Black Sheep, Orsay, and Bellwether Restaurants.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, the Jaguars blow a fourth quarter lead and lose their final home game of the year. Pretty depressing, but still a pretty spirited crowd around the stadium Sunday. Cole Pepper is here to take us through the lowlights of this one. Hey, good morning.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, it kind of feels like the kind of game that is a microcosm of the entire season in so many ways. Jaguars looked like they had a shot early and then faded at the end. The breaks didn't go their way. Jaguars had struggles with the offensive line. You can kind of come up with a lot of different storylines that showed where the Jaguars went wrong yesterday and project those on the entire season. A 16-13, the final score, and a last-second field goal by Washington. The Jaguars led in the fourth quarter, then gave up the lead, were tied. But even then, the Jaguars had a chance with under 3 minutes to play. Cody Kessler completed a third and six pass to D.D. Westbrook for a first down. That got the Jaguars to the Washington 21, would have been in field goal range. But Dante Moncrief on that play called for offensive pass interference. On the very next play, Kessler's pass to Westbrook was too high and intercepted by Washington. Skins drove down the field and to set up the game-winning field goal as time expired. The Jaguars are now 4-10. They've lost 9 of their last 10 games, and they have as many losses this year as they did wins last year. So as excited as people were for the wins last year, it's exactly the opposite this year in terms of the numbers, and I think also in terms of the enthusiasm. Folks are a lot of fans are just already looking to the offseason, looking ahead, and wondering what comes next. Jaguars are going to be underdogs in their final two games at Miami and at Houston. If they finish 4-12, have to ask the question, is Doug Marrone's job in jeopardy? Here's what Marrone had to say about it after the game, as well as comments from Calais Campbell and Jalen Ramsey.
My job is to win games, and you don't win games. You know, obviously, it's up to the people that make the decisions. It's very simple. I'm not going to back down from my responsibility from the team.
I'm a fan of his as a coach. I think he's a really good coach. I like playing for him. And I think that, his style and, you know, what we want to do, I feel like it could be successful. It could be very successful.
Don't worry about nobody but myself.
That's Jalen Ramsey with the last one.
Not surprising to hear that, yeah.
And by the way, he got a lot of flack on social media after those comments were reported. I don't have a real problem with Jalen Ramsey saying he's only concerned about himself because he's got his own stuff to deal with right now. There's a lot going on. This is sort of a stay in your lane kind of comment. I think because it came from Jalen and because he's seen as, you know, having this big personality and
kind of a bad boy.
I mean, I'm not sure bad boy is the right thing, but
what would you call it then?
Mercurial maybe is the right word for it. A little bit of a diva. Those kind of things. I don't think of Jalen as a bad boy. He's not, you know, getting in trouble off the field or anything like that. It's mm-hmm. you know, some on the field trash talk and pouting and moping sometimes. A guy who doesn't handle losing well at all. But my take here on Doug Marrone's situation is that he certainly didn't forget how to coach from last year when he took the team to the AFC Championship game. So it's not a lack of knowledge. It's not a lack of effort He's a, you know, old school blue collar hard worker. He's putting the time in. He's grinding away at it. He's not throwing anybody under the bus. He's taking the blame for himself. He doesn't, you know, expose players in the media unduly. But I do wonder about whether his message is landing this year. Something he's brought up on several occasions about the message that he's saying, that what he's is not always being translated, what happens on the field. Now, I also will point out that there were a number of young players who got extensive playing time in the game yesterday, and I think we're going to see that the rest of the way. I think part of the reason that's happening is because the Jaguars as an organization are starting to look forward to next year. Marone deflected those questions after the game in his postgame press conference, but if I'm a coach fighting for my job, I'm probably not bringing a guy up off the practice squad and playing him substantial time as he did yesterday with the Jaguars. So I think it's likely that Marone has been told, hey, you've got some time. You'll be back next year. Let's try to get a jump start on next season and see how it all plays out. And
yeah, let's just hope next season goes a little better than this season. Okay, before we let you go, high school basketball in the spotlight over the weekend.
Yeah, 3 days of games at the High School 912 Invitational, won by Providence, who outclassed the field. Senior Aaron Freeman was the MVP. He's heading to the University of New Orleans. It was a first-of-its-kind event and met with rave reviews. Here's what Providence head coach Jim Martin and Jerry Buckley of Bishop Kenny told me about the tournament.
We've been fortunate to play in some national tournaments, City of Palm, Myrtle Beach. This, with what Alan Verlander are doing, is off the chart. It feels so good for our kids in the basketball community to be in a tournament like this. This is what Jacksonville's needed for a long time.
I think it's exciting to get all the schools here. You know, there's really good basketball in Jacksonville. I think obviously gets overlooked sometimes in football and all the sports as well. So it's exciting, and it brings a lot of excitement to the basketball community, and hopefully grows every year.
Jerry Buckley certainly is right. Football is king in Jacksonville, high school, college, pro. But it was great to be a part of that and called the championship game Saturday on TV, and to be able to see the enthusiasm that those schools, those kids, and the parents who were involved really have for what's going on was a lot of fun.
Yeah, congrats to them. Always good to see you. Cole Pepper's regular Monday sports segment brought to us by the Black Sheep Restaurant Group. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Melissa.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our director. And if you missed anything this morning, catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. 1A is up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Enjoy your Monday.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.